This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela Lafrak. Lawmakers are back at the Statehouse today for a veto session that is potentially historic as they seek to override eight bills Republican Governor Phil Scott has rejected. Both the democratically led House and Senate will need a two-thirds majority in favor to get the overrides needed to pass those bills. And joining us today from Montpelier are Vermont Public Reporters Bob Kinzel and Peter Hirschfeld. Thank you both for joining us today.
Happy veto session day, Mitch.
Great to talk to you, Mitch.
Also in Montpelier, VT Diggers, Southern Vermont Education and Corrections reporter Ethan Weinstein. Ethan, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Bob Kinzel, let's start with you, senior political correspondent. You've been through these a time or two yourself. How does a veto session work in Vermont? And given what is going on today, how late do you expect to be there tonight?
Well, I have no idea how late we're going to be here. You never know. There could be a dramatic debate over one of these bills. But of the seven bills that are being considered, Mitch, they're all House bills. So they originate in the House. And so far today, we've seen the House override the governor's veto on three bills. That would be Act 250, also the property tax bill, and a harm reduction bill, also involving drug use. Those three bills the House has overridden. They're now being sent over to the Senate, and the Senate will consider them during the lunch hour. And so things are moving along pretty quickly. But you never know what's going to happen here. Is there going to be a last-minute compromise on any of these things? Right now, the House members seem to have some very strong votes. But some of these votes in the Senate could be a little closer. And, you know, just for a little bit of perspective, Calvin Cutler over at Channel 3 did some great research on vetoes, and he mentioned it on Vermont This Week on Friday night. And that is, in the first 225 years of Vermont, there have been 145 vetoes. Now, in the last 8 years, 145 total, Scott has vetoed 51 bills. Now, that is 25% of all the vetoes in the history of the state of Vermont. And if you ever needed a statistic that shows, the difference in legislative priorities and gubernatorial priorities and different issues coming before the legislature, boy, that statistic really stands out for me.
Yeah, that really leapt out as me as well when we were talking about that on Vermont This Week. It is rather incredible. That is a record. I think Howard Dean had set the record before that for vetoes, but certainly that's been surpassed at this point. Bob, you mentioned the property tax bill, probably the most watched bill at this point. I'm wondering, you know, the House, we kind of expected that they would override that. And we do know that it might be a little bit closer with the Senate votes. Now, I think you had reported this morning that the replacement for Dick Mazza, who was appointed by Governor Scott, has been sworn in. Is that correct at this point?
That is correct. And right now, the Senate has 29 members because Senator Sears passed away recently and there has been no appointment made there for a replacement. So you still need 20 votes in the Senate to override a veto. That, you know, depending on how some of these bills come, and to be very honest, I'm not sure how the Senate is going to vote on some of these bills. That one vote could make a difference.
Okay, yeah. So this passings of Senators Sears and Mazza could have an effect on all of this. Pete Hirschfeld, give us an idea about what is happening, especially with this property tax bill known as the yield bill. If it's overridden by the House and Senate, I understand that statewide property taxes would rise by almost 14% next year. Is that right? What has Governor Phil Scott said about that potential rise in property taxes?
Well, breaking news, the Senate did just override the so-called yield bill. So that will be enacted into law as it passed the legislature last month. And yes, that will result in an average increase in statewide property taxes of 13.8%. To be clear, the way school financing works in Vermont is that local school boards pass budgets, and then the legislature crafts a funding plan to pay for those budgets. So the property tax bill that you see from lawmakers is not something that they came up with on a whim. This is what they've deemed rates need to be in order to pay for this more than $2 billion in school spending that local districts have approved. You know, the governor has said this is untenable. Vermonters can't afford this. People are going to leave the state. People are going to be priced out of their homes. Lawmakers say, look, we don't disagree that this is a huge problem, but the school has made these decisions, and we are obligated to set property tax rates that are going to be sufficient to pay for those budgets. They've created a study committee that they say will sort of set the stage for some more structural overhauls in the coming legislative sessions that will get at the issue of spending and seek ways to curb it in the future. But they say the circumstances we're in right now require this admittedly high property tax increase.
And again, if you're just joining us, Pete Hirschfeld breaking the news that now both the House and Senate have overridden Governor Scott's veto of that yield bill. So we are looking at a property tax increase of about 14% next year. Pete, the governor had said that their alternative was to end the Universal School Meals program in Vermont and also to use some reserves in Vermont to buy down some of those property taxes. And again, that plan is not going to happen at this point, but the governor and his administration was saying that that would bring down property taxes a lot more. What kind of a forecast were they making there?
They said that if the legislature adopted their plan in whole, adopted the administration's plan in whole, they would be able to get property tax increases to 4 to 6% increase, as opposed to 13.8% increase under the legislature's bill. The legislature, though, said for a number of reasons that this is not the path ahead. And Ethan has actually been covering this issue in a very in-depth. And so I would throw it to you, Ethan, to talk about some of the concerns that Democratic lawmakers had as it relates to the administration's plan.
Yeah, I think they have a number of concerns, perhaps the greatest among them being using the entirety of the education fund's $47 million stabilization reserve. That was one of the ideas, perhaps the boldest, proposed by the Scott administration. That pot of money sits in the education fund for emergencies, recessions, perhaps. And leaders in the administration have said, well, perhaps this property tax increase driven by school spending is one of those emergencies. But Democratic leadership quickly panned that idea as fiscally irresponsible. And they would say the administration's other proposals are similarly irresponsible, whether that's getting rid of universal school meals, which allows all kids to eat for free in school, or relying on about $20 million in revenue surplus from state government that has yet to come in. They say those are things we can't bet on, or changes we can't make at this point.
And Ethan, they were concerned as well about Vermont's bond rating being affected if they had gone with the governor's plan. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so the rating agencies have said that having these reserve funds, I believe we have one in our general fund and transportation fund as well, they're part of what gives Vermont such a strong bond rating. Now, I know that administration officials would say school spending, increasing at the rates we're seeing, that could also pose a risk to our bond rating. But when the administration proposed a version of this idea originally in the legislature, Democratic Treasurer Mike Pichek came before lawmakers and said, I can't recommend a plan that would basically loan money to ourselves to buy down rates this year.
And Ethan, I want to stick with you for a moment because I know you've been covering a lot of issues related to the restorative justice bill. Can you explain, first of all, what restorative justice, what that bill does in Vermont, and why Governor Scott wanted to veto an expansion of it statewide?
You know, Mitch, it's really not a focus of mine. I do know that. Oh, no worries. I know that there were some concerned about unfunded positions, but Bob, I don't know if this one is something you've been tracking.
Well, it's certainly a program, Mitch, that's been in place for a number of years, and it's used really to resolve mostly lower-level criminal offenses, and it's viewed as sort of an alternative to the traditional criminal justice system. And what it requires is really a mediation between the victim and the perpetrator for these crimes that really holds the perpetrator accountable and responsible for the crime. And if that happens, then the perpetrator is able to avoid jail time, and I think, Pete, even a criminal sentence in that case. And so it's been a successful program, and folks would like to expand it statewide, but that is going to take a little money, and the governor says, hey, you can't pass this bill as an unfunded mandate and then say, well, next year we'll come back and find the money. I think I have that sort of close.
Right now. The restorative justice system is sort of administered by the Department of Corrections, and lawmakers feel like there's a lot of geographic inequity when it comes to access to the restorative justice process. So what this bill would do is house the restorative justice program in the Office of the Attorney General, and it directs the Office of the Attorney General to go out to all 14 counties and strategize with prosecutors, victims, advocates on ways to create a more robust restorative justice infrastructure as an alternative to the traditional criminal justice system. Attorney General Charity Clark had asked lawmakers to fund an additional position in her office to be able to begin some of that work. Lawmakers did not do that. That's one of the reasons that Phil Scott said he vetoed the bill. But Attorney General Charity Clark has been crystal clear with lawmakers. We do not need that position. It would be great to have it, but we don't need it. And Charity Clark is urging lawmakers to override that veto today. She says her office can summon the resources needed to get this work going. And she says the lack of funding should not be an obstacle or impediment to making this happen.
And Pete, we were hearing from a lot of lawmakers in rural parts of the state saying this is where it's most needed, where that it's happening in Chittenden County and places like that, but more rural parts of the state need this as well. Does it look like right now the votes might be there to override?
It does, Mitch. I had some conversations with legislative leaders earlier today, and heading in to this morning's votes, leaders in both chambers were exceedingly confident that they were going to have the votes needed to override every vetoed bill except for the data privacy bill, which does not have the votes needed for an override in the Senate. We should also mention, Mitch, you mentioned the 8 vetoes that Governor Phil Scott has issued. One of those came early on in the session. It was related to a ban on flavored vaping products. That is not something that lawmakers will attempt to override today.
Mitch, I just wanted put one emphasis on the yield bill, and that is, you know, I think the political system reacts when there's a crisis. And if there really is a crisis going on, that moves lawmakers. And, you know, we've seen different changes in school funding in Vermont over the last 40 or 50 years. And I don't know, I have a sense, I'd be interested if Ethan and Pete feel this way. We're on the verge of a change. I don't know what that change is going to be. I don't think lawmakers know what it's going to be. But I think the current system has pretty much run its course. And one of the reasons I think that lawmakers are willing to accept an almost 14% increase in spending, it keeps the pressure on. Now, if they'd done something to buy down the rate to 4% or 5%, then folks would say, well, crisis? What crisis? And would it take some of the urgency away? And when they come back, I'm not sure what the time frame for the different commissions are going to be. But this is the time for Vermont to totally reevaluate how it finances education. And the pressure is on. And that 14% increase really does keep the pressure on.
Well, Ethan, let me ask you this. You know, wasn't there some talk about, you know, doing a study commission or something to just change the way Vermont funds its education, you know, system? With the property tax tied to education spending, seems like the kind of thing that lawmakers wanted to take a deeper look at.
There have been a number of study committees in the past, and we're going to have another one as a result of this yield bill. So a group of some lawmakers, some experts in the field will be convening this summer to think about how can Vermont create a more sustainable education funding system going forward. Because, Bob, I think you're right that the system we have, many feel that it has run its course. Vermont's school funding formula is incredibly idiosyncratic, incredibly complicated. It's a pain to explain. Many people can't explain it. So I think that there is some appetite for moving towards a system that might be more similar to what exists in other parts of the country. Legislators have studied pivoting towards an income-based system rather than property tax. That never really went anywhere. And so we're going to have to be following closely this summer to see what they come up with, because they are they're ordered to come back to the legislative session next year with legislation in hand.
And Mitch, I think a lot of key lawmakers would say just shifting from the property tax to the income tax really doesn't solve the problem. You've got school spending going up. I mean, we have inflation, we have health care costs, we have salaries. Schools are providing more social services. So there has to be some cost containment or some way of looking at holding towns more accountable for their own spending. So if just not to pick on Cabot, but if Cabot wants to have 40 students in their high school, then maybe there has to be a financial component to that that they're going to have to pay for. And if they decide, if residents and voters in Cabot say, hey, yeah, we want to keep our high school and we're willing to pay for it, there needs to be a stronger connection between local spending and tax burden.
We've already heard one big piece of news, that the yield bill, which regards property taxes in Vermont, that Governor Phil Scott vetoed, has been overridden by both the House and the Senate. So Vermont will be looking at a 13.8% increase in property tax rates to pay for education starting next year. Before we went to break, I am so fascinated by the political component to all this, because, you know, these overrides don't happen in a vacuum, and there are going to be consequences. Fair to say, and I'm going to open this question to all of you and let the first one jump in to tackle this one. Governor Scott has indicated that while he may lose the veto battle today, because he understands there are supermajorities in both the House and the Senate, and he doesn't have the numbers, he feels confident that his priorities and his legislative philosophy will win the overall war when Vermonters head to the polls in November in a few months. Is that something, do you think, he's banking on? Don't all jump in at once.
I think Phil Scott's political calculus right now is related far less to his own campaign for governor and far more about down ballot races for the House and Senate. Phil Scott has, over the course of this legislative session, adopted a new kind of messaging. It's something we haven't heard until quite recently in his, you know, four-term tenure, where he's basically preemptively ceding his veto power to the supermajority of Democrats in both the House and Senate. He wants voters, Vermonters, to hear that loud and clear, that he used to be able to veto a bill and have some degree of certainty that that veto would mean it would not become law. He said those times have long since passed, that Democrats have sufficient numbers, Democrats and progressives have sufficient numbers in the House and Senate to sort of legislate unilaterally without that check from the Republican executive. And his pitch to Vermonters is, if you want, obviously you like me, right? I'm the most popular governor in the United States. I win by overwhelming majorities in general elections. If you appreciate the sort of leadership that I bring, the sort of governance that I bring, you need to elect more Republicans and conservative Democrats to the House and Senate, because if we don't shift that balance, I'm going to be very limited in terms of my ability not only to advance my own agenda, but to check the policy direction of the Democrats, which he would suggest is making the state less affordable by adding taxes and increasing the costs of everything from electricity to heating oil.
I wonder if he was emboldened in that approach by the number, the vast majority, not vast majority, but the huge number of school budgets that were voted down this year, because we saw a number of budgets, a record, almost record number, I think, that got voted down, and then some only passed after a second or a third vote.
Yeah, I mean, we have some budgets going on their fifth vote at this point. Hmm. Leading up to town meeting day, the governor had said that he would vote no on his local school budget, and that proved to be how many Vermonters voted. There was a moment this past legislative session when the governor had said that he was working to recruit more moderate lawmakers to run for office, whether they be perhaps moderate Republicans like himself or more conservative Democrats. We now know that there are not a ton of Republicans challenging for seats in the House and Senate. It doesn't seem like there's going to be a wave of moderate Republicans filling new seats, but there is still time for independents to run. And so we're going to see if Vermonters want more moderate leadership like the governor.
And, you know, Mitch, I think what it also highlights for folks is what is the proper role of state government in dealing with major issues facing the state? And we see the governor talking about very limited government, more fully engaging the private sector. We see the Democrats seeing a larger role for state government. And, you know, it's fascinating that voters will go in and vote for Phil Scott and will vote for perhaps a liberal Democrat in a House race. And we've often asked the governor, do you think that voters are doing this knowingly, that they want to have balance? Mm. And he never thinks that that's the case. You know, and it may be a case, too, where you know, people, if you ask people what they think of Congress, they'll go, oh, Congress, U.S. House and U.S. Senate. Oh, it's terrible. I don't like what they're doing down there at all. How do you feel about your local members of Congress? Oh, well, I like them. And I wonder if some of that is true at the state level as well. There may be some criticism of the Democratic legislature, but that folks really do like their local leaders, and they will be supporting most of the bills where the veto is going to be overridden.
Bob, what about how the lawmakers feel, though, about each other? I mean, it does seem to me that, you know, we always have this push and pull between the more conservative Governor Phil Scott and the more liberal members of the House and Senate. But does it seem to you that there is more rancor this session than there has been in some time?
Well, I think there is between the House and the Senate Democratic leadership and the governor's office. There's certainly more rancor than I've seen in a long, long time. And you could see that over the way they reacted to the governor's proposal for the yield bill. I mean, they got into arguments about why wasn't the governor there making the presentation. And I mean, it's really gotten quite bitter between the Democrats and the governor, which is, you know, it's sort of clouding a lot of different considerations of other issues as well. But it will be fascinating to see how voters look at this in November.
A lot of other bills that are coming up today. One of them has to do with what's called a safe injection site for Vermont's largest city. That would be Burlington. There are lawmakers who are saying, look, the opioid problem in Vermont has gotten completely out of hand. We've seen record numbers of deaths. We're seeing all kinds of really terrible outcomes from this kind of drug use. And this would set up a safe injection site in Burlington where people could use drugs. There would be overdose reversal medication on hand. But it would also be something that people would see. And this is something, a bill that Governor Scott has vetoed. What do the chances look like for an override there? Ethan, is this something that's in your purview? And what is Scott saying about why he wants to veto this bill?
Well, I've been following it a little bit, and I might pass it off to Pete in a second. But I know that the House did vote to override this morning. I think proponents of the bill would say that this is about saving lives, right? Having trained medical staff on site who could reverse an overdose. And we know that people are using drugs in public already. And so this would move that to a supervised location. Pete, do you know what the governor has said about why he doesn't support this legislation?
Yeah, it's just, you know, he said a couple of things. He said, it just doesn't seem right, right? That's the one thing, that it's just difficult for some people to wrap their head around the idea of a government sort of overtly condoning what is illegal. And the governor also says that he thinks that there are other prevention strategies that Vermont has initiated that are working, that are meeting with success. And he said it does not make sense to him to invest millions of dollars on what he would argue is an unproven strategy, and in doing so, take away money that would otherwise flow to these other programs. The people that support these overdose prevention centers, as they're known now, say, you know, in the history of these things, nobody's ever died at one. Nobody has ever had a fatal overdose at an overdose prevention center. And they say that is a testament to the life-saving power that these things have. They also say these are opportunities to sort of meet people where they're at. You can forge relationships with people when they realize it's a non-judgmental zone, and that they can ask for help when they're ready for it. They say this can often be sort of a springboard into rehabilitation for people. So the Senate almost certainly has the votes to override. That was at least what I was hearing as of very recently this morning. So it would appear that we're going to find out soon just how an overdose prevention center would work in Vermont and what it would look like, because this is going to become law over the governor's objections, and Burlington will be blazing new ground.
And you know, Mitch, yeah, I think that the supporters of the bill look at the over 640 opioid deaths that have happened in Vermont over the last 3 years. And I don't think they look at this bill as a panacea. I think they see it as another option. It's part of what the state can do in an overall sense. And I think a very important part of it is what Pete mentioned, is if you bring folks into these centers, you can then discuss with them other social services that are available. And that could have a meaningful impact on their lives. So I think that the supporters of the bill see this as, you know, we've tried different treatment programs. Some of them have worked. Some of them haven't. We got to try a new approach. This is a pilot program. Well, let's see how it works in Burlington.
And Bob, I'm sorry to break in again, Mitch,
go
real
ahead,
quickly,
please.
Though. So Vermont public education reporter Lola Dufour is heroically bringing us updates as they come in through the glass here. The overdose prevention bill override vote in the Senate has failed. It
Wow.
has gone down. So the governor's veto will be sustained. That override vote failed by one vote. So that's just to somebody that covers the legislature day in and day out, that to me is a surprising vote.
I was going to say that does sound a little bit surprising. And thanks, Lola Dufour, of course, for keeping us up to date to the minute on that potential vote. I was going to ask Bob, you know, before we heard that, if it's safe to say that those who were in favor of the safe injection site were saying on some level, we've got to try something because of those number of deaths you were talking about. It almost felt like this was maybe not the best option, but at least it was trying something different. The governor had mentioned some numbers ticking down on opioid overdose deaths, but as I understand it, those numbers were not yet complete. And it's in other words, you know, for the year, it was still early on to say that there was success with these other attempts.
Mitch, I think you have it exactly right. The supporters were saying, let's just try something else. It may not be the total answer, but let's give it a try. Let's set up the pilot program in Burlington. And I think the vote is a little surprising, because when I went back and looked at the original vote in the Senate, it looked like it had the votes to override the governor's veto. So a couple of people seemingly have changed their minds on this issue, and that's something we'll look into later today.
Renewable energy is coming up. The governor vetoed a policy that would require each utility in the state to get 100% of its power from renewables by the year 2035. Any updates on that one? I'm wondering if we're going to be getting all sorts of information coming in faster than we can handle it at this point. What does it look like for a potential override of the renewable energy standard bill?
Well, you know, as of this morning, both chambers were feeling confident. As we just learned with the Overdose Prevention Center bill, anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the governor is calling people into his office. There's a lot of people trying to be very persuasive right now. But as it stood, leaders in both chambers thought they had the votes needed to override this bill, which would subject electric utilities to new clean energy mandates. It would, by 2035 at the latest, require all utilities in Vermont to be sourcing 100% of their power from renewable sources. There are some provisions in this legislation that would also require a certain percentage of that energy to come from local renewable generation, local meaning either Vermont or in New England. The governor vetoed this bill because he has some real severe concerns about what this is going to do to rates in this state. He estimates that Vermonters will be paying on the order of billions of dollars more in electrical rates as a result of this legislation. His administration put forward a plan that got to 100% renewables, but that was more agnostic on where those renewables come from. There's a lot of energy surrounding this bill around Vermont, both for and against it. And I think along with the yield bill, it's one of those pieces of legislation that is going to have some, you know, some legs on the campaign trail.
Another bill that we're looking at has to do with neonicotinoid pesticides. And yes, I am proud of myself because I've been practicing that word for quite some time. Every time I get it right, I praise myself. But look, this is kind of an important bill too, because we're looking at these pesticides. They're used in nearly all the corn and soy seed that's grown in the U.S. They're coated with these pesticides. And the governor vetoed this bill, which would have banned the use of it in Vermont, because he said it was anti-farmer. This is something the beekeeping industry has disagreed vehemently about. What is the consensus in Montpelier? Who'd like to tackle that one and where we stand with the neonicotinoid pesticides bill?
I will hop in here, Mitch,
please.
Only because I'm the designated neonicotinoid reporter today.
You've been practicing that word too.
So,
well said, Pete. Okay.
Yeah, you know, this is a neonicotinoids are something that have been banned in a lot of jurisdictions, including the EU, where they adopt more of a precautionary principle when it comes to regulating potentially harmful compounds. You, like you said, beekeepers, one very vocal constituency about the harm of these pesticides, and they say we should, like our neighbors to the north in Quebec, not allow farmers to use seeds that are coated with this pesticide. Farmers in Vermont, though, say this could add really significant costs. They say neonicotinoids are a solution to a real problem, and that it's unclear to them what an alternative solution would look like right now. Secretary of Agriculture Anson Tebbets said his agency is not unilaterally opposed to this measure, but he said farmers are going to need a couple years to sort of figure out how to make this transition, if and when Vermont decides that this transition needs to be made. So the governor came down on the side of the agriculture interests in this state, and folks that are looking to err more on the environmental side are pleading with lawmakers today to override that veto.
Pete, do you think this is a bill where the state is taking, the lawmakers want to take an action that's going to end up in a lawsuit? I'm thinking of some other bills that they've taken on as well, that eventually this is going to have to be litigated in the courts?
You know, I just don't know if that's where it's, I know that other jurisdictions have already done this. I don't know what sort of legal consequences derive from that, but we'll see.
We're also looking at the data privacy bill. I know that was brought up a little bit earlier. Can one of you speak to what that bill would do and why the governor is against it?
So the data privacy bill is a wide-ranging, complex piece of legislation that would do two fundamental things. One, it would force social media companies to make their platforms less addictive to kids. We know these features, infinite scroll, right? Those pop-up notifications.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of medical experts that say these are incredibly destructive for children, that their lives begin to revolve around them in ways that are extremely unhealthy. So that's one aspect of the bill. The other would prohibit tech companies, or all companies really, from selling sensitive personal data that belongs to consumers. And it would also allow Vermonters to sue large data brokers that misuse their sensitive personal information. Governor Phil Scott heard from really an overwhelming number of businesses who said the compliance costs associated with this, the potential for frivolous lawsuits from unscrupulous lawyers, have the potential to put us out of business. We're talking about, you know, serious Vermont businesses. Burton, for instance, put out a plea to Chittenden County lawmakers just a couple days ago. The governor's veto is in direct response to those business interests, and members of the Senate have heard them as well. The Senate lost 7 votes, I believe, on this bill. They do not have the votes to override, and so they aren't even going to bother taking it up, and mm-hmm. this will be an issue that comes up again in 2025.